From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the 2016 election and Russian trolls aiming Facebook ads directly at Wisconsin and Michigan.
The fact that some of these ads were targeted toward Michigan and Wisconsin is significant because, as your listeners know, Donald Trump won the election there by margin of less than 1%.
Plus, Grand Rapids takes on chronic student absenteeism.
If you miss 4 days of school, that's really the breaking point when you start to be successful or not successful.
File a FOIA request in Michigan and get sued?
They get slapped with a lawsuit that's not permitted under our statute, and they incur those costs and fees.
And fish riding the rails in Michigan in the 1880s.
Well, I don't know about it in style. They were in converted milk cans.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up today, a new tactic public universities, government offices, and other public entities in Michigan are using to avoid providing information to taxpayers and journalists who have a legal right to know what's going on. We learn more from a First Amendment attorney later in the hour. Also, a fish may not need a bicycle, but at one point in Michigan history, fish needed a train. But first, Congress continues to investigate ways that Russia tried to meddle in the 2016 election, particularly through social media. The Senate Intelligence Committee has asked Facebook, Google, and Twitter to testify at a hearing November 1st, and the House Intelligence Committee will do the same sometime this month. Now, an exclusive report from CNN puts Michigan in the center of this investigation with Russian trolls and Facebook ads. Dylan Byers is senior reporter for media and politics at CNN. Dylan, your story cites four sources with direct knowledge of this Russian trolling. What are they telling you?
Well, Cindy, what they're telling us is that these 3,000, at least 3,000 Russian bot Facebook ads, a portion of them were targeted toward the state's of both Michigan and Wisconsin. That joins a list of other states. But the fact that some of those ads, and we know that some of those ads were trying to stoke anti-Muslim sentiment, among other things, a lot of the themes we've seen have to do with race, immigration, refugees, pro-gun rights. I mean, it really spans the full spectrum of sort of hot-button political issues. But the fact that some of these ads were targeted toward Michigan and Wisconsin is significant because, as your listeners know, Donald Trump won the election there by a margin of less than 1%. We've been talking to Facebook, we've been talking to folks on Capitol Hill. Have they confirmed that this influenced the election? No. Are they worried that it might have played a role in influencing the election? Yes. And so that's something that both Congress, Special Counsel Robert Mueller, they're going to be looking at that as they conduct their ongoing investigations into Russian meddling in the election.
Dylan, do we know if these ads were Michiganized in some way? Were they tailored for the state of Michigan?
Well, we're still learning about the ads, but I think everything we've learned up until this point tells us that it's very probable. And here's the reason I say that. We've also learned the other week about a Black Lives Matter ad meant to sort of both encourage protesters, African Americans, to come out and protest, and also to sort of encourage perhaps white voters to view the Black Lives Matter movement as a threat. We saw those ads targeted very specifically at both Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, two cities that were sort of at the forefront of the violent protests in response to police shootings of African American men. That level of sophistication, understanding where susceptible audiences would be, I would be shocked if we didn't see a similar level of strategy, similar level of sophistication in terms of how ads were targeted to a state like Michigan. Absolutely.
And I know this is all still kind of eking out this information. Do we know anything about maybe which areas of Michigan were targeted by the Russian troll farms?
We don't know the specific areas, but we do know that they were and this is, again, based off of the four sources we spoke to, they were strategically targeted at specific voting groups. We are still, it is like scratching at the side of a mountain to try and get Facebook and Congress to be more forthcoming about what they've seen, about what they know. But there were specific voting blocks. These were not blanket campaigns across the state of Michigan. These were ads that were specifically targeted to people who would be susceptible the messages. And I just want to pull back too and contextualize this a little bit, which is all of these ads, some were pro-Donald Trump, some were anti-Hillary Clinton, but the vast majority of the ads were geared at sowing discord and driving a wedge between Americans, whether that was on issues of race, of gun rights, of Muslims, of immigration. We're sure that's what happened in Michigan. We're sure that's what happened in Wisconsin.
And do your sources have any indication that these Russian trolls got any kind of help from people in the Trump campaign?
So that is the million-dollar question. One thing that we know the special counsel is looking for is any evidence of collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign. The way these ads could play a role in that, if the counsel finds, or indeed if Congress finds, that you had an ad, let's say an anti-Muslim ad, or an ad that tied Hillary Clinton to support among Muslim women. Let's say you had that ad specifically targeted at, theoretically, let's call it, middle-aged women living in the suburbs of Detroit. And you found similar ads targeted by the Trump campaign to the same groups of people, same place, same messaging. That begins to paint a picture of cooperation, of collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign. No evidence of that yet, but that's certainly what they're looking for.
Your reporting certainly adds weight to the belief that Facebook was weaponized for the 2016 election. What do you think Facebook users and Twitter and other forms of social media need to put in their minds before they reflexively hit that share button?
I think, look, there's nothing that's more significant than media literacy. You need to really understand where you're getting your news from. You need to think carefully about sources. I know there's a big conversation out there. The President of the United States himself is trying to delegitimize mainstream news organizations. Every mainstream news organization out there is making a good faith effort to try and bring you the honest news. But other things that you don't know where they come from, things that have shady names you don't recognize, think twice about before sharing that information. Think twice before believing that information.
Dylan, how much is Facebook feeling the heat from this?
They're feeling the heat a lot. I've never seen the tide of public sentiment turn so swiftly against a tech company. It's pretty amazing. You know, these tech companies been around for over a decade, really had public support behind them. A lot of sort of celebration over new products, new platforms they release. Now, all of a sudden, there's a lot of scrutiny on these companies.
Dylan Byers, senior reporter for media and politics at CNN. We'll look forward to continuing talking with you as this investigation unfolds.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Michigan State University is paying more than $1 million for some of the best lawyers in the country. They're investigating how a former MSU sports doctor could allegedly abuse dozens and dozens of young patients for years, and whether anybody at MSU knew about it. But as Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, there's no plan to release those results.
When MSU's internal investigation is done, the school is going to look great. That is a direct quote from one of the school's trustees, Joel Ferguson, on WXYZ-TV this spring.
MSU's going to look great. And MSU wants to get the bottom of this also.
But the thing is, we may never know what MSU looks like in this internal review, good, bad, or ugly.
This internal review was never designed to end in a report. So I don't want to act like there is a plan to have some report. It's what we're referring to as an action-oriented review.
This is Jason Cody. He is the university spokesman. He's a guy who, one imagines, has had a very busy year. We meet up on campus late this summer on one of those gorgeous, kind of sleepy days before fall semester starts. We're in one of those classic old brick buildings at MSU. It's literally named Olds Hall, and there's a little window unit doing its best to fight the heat. But just for a second, I want to jump to another campus.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
This is former FBI Director Louis Free. He's speaking in 2012, and he was famously hired by Penn State's trustees to figure out who knew what about former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky and his abuse of children. It became known as the Free Report. Everything he found put out for the world to see.
We are here today because of a terrible tragedy was allowed to occur over many years at Penn State University.
Now, today, in 2017, MSU has also hired a team of lawyers, including a former federal prosecutor, to pore over sport doctor Larry Nassar's work at MSU. Those attorneys are going through hundreds of interviews and emails, and they are taking what they find directly to the Board of Trustees. And Jason Cody, the spokesman, understands that it is frustrating not having some kind of public report, not just for Nassar's alleged victims, but for anybody who's just been reading about this in the news, seeing a few victims claim that they told someone at MSU about this years ago.
They want accountability. They want to know someone said this that they told someone.
Is it true or not?
Is it true or not?
Yes.
We're in the middle of litigation, Kate. That's just not something that we are going to be able to discuss.
Here's what MSU is doing with that internal review. One, they are using that information to defend themselves against lawsuits filed by Nassar's alleged victims. And two, Cody says, they are figuring out where the school needs to get better and already starting to make those fixes, like reminding staff that they can be fired for not reporting assault and making a big new push for patient safety and hiring experts to review MSU's Title IX office, athletic training, healthcare teams. That is a kind of accountability, Cody says. But is it enough? Patty Daly Lewis says no. As a former deputy attorney general for the state of Delaware, she helped prosecute one of the worst pedophile cases in American history, a pediatrician who allegedly abused more than 100 patients.
They have to be willing to be dissected in front of everybody. They have to be willing to have people say, mistakes were made. We can't undo them right now, but we can make damn sure it doesn't happen again.
She says MSU's decision not to release whatever their internal review finds is a mistake, because even if they find really good things that look good for MSU, it just leaves people imagining the worst.
You know, anything that is only for us makes people think what?
That you're hiding something.
Exactly. No further questions. Why wouldn't you let everybody see this?
MSU has a moment right now, she says. What they're going to do with that moment is something we're going to talk about tomorrow. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Coming up, our friends from the Michigan History Center stop by for another history lesson. And Stateside's Mercedes Mejia introduces us to the Zappa-esque West Michigan band, Desmond Jones. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
You might have heard the phrase, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bike. But did you know, in the 1880s, leaders in Michigan decided that in our state, fish needed a train. It's Wednesday, time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And, of course, today we're happy to welcome back State Archivist Mark Harvey. So, Mark, a fish train? Really?
Yeah, a fish train.
What was going on in Michigan for the folks in Lansing to say, we need a fish train?
This was before there was any state departments. There were just commissions, so that we had the Michigan Fish Commission. And this is right at the tail end of our logging boom when Michigan was a leader in providing pine lumber for the country. So all that logging activity had really degraded the landscape and had done a number on our pristine rivers. So that combined with this East Coast sportsman named Charles Halleck, he published a book in 1873 called The Fishing Tourist. And he devoted an entire chapter in that book on his trip to Michigan and the wonders of angling for this peculiar fish called the grayling that not too many people knew about. And Michigan instantly became a hot spot for sportsmen. So you combine the logging degradation with sportsmen now flocking to Michigan to fish with pretty much little regulation.
So there was kind of a supply and demand problem.
Yeah, it was so popular, the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad renamed themselves the Fishing Line just to appeal to sportsmen. So it created a resource problem.
Okay, so they needed to get fish out there into the waters. Why would a fish train be the best way to do that?
the soundest scientific method of repopulating fish was through the hatchery system. And as early as 1867, private individuals were rearing fish, and the state caught up on that in the 1870s and began opening their own hatchery buildings. It was not cost effective, though, to open up a hatchery in every county. We have 83 counties, so simple economics meant we got to have a few hatcheries and distribute the fish from there. You couldn't do that by horse and carriage. That's not efficient. This is pre-automobile, and even when we had the automobile, we didn't have the infrastructure to distribute via automobile, so rail was the only option.
So the fish train car, tell us about that. How was it designed?
The first one was commissioned in 1888, and the fish commissioners contracted with the Litchfield Car Company out of Illinois, and they built a custom rail car. It was a baggage car that they converted for transporting fish. So, you know, it had sleeping berths, it had room for milk cans of the fish fingerlings for distribution. It's very similar to what I've read about logging camps. You know, there was a cook and they traveled around the state. They usually averaged 25 to 30,000 miles a year, and they would just connect with existing passenger lines and be one of many cars, and they would be dropped off at different points around the state to distribute the fish.
So this was a full-time thing. This wasn't just, we're going to send them out, do it, and we're done.
Yeah, it was every year starting in 1888. There was a succession of three different rail cars, and it ended in 1937.
Why? What brought about the end for the fish train?
By 1937, we had our second actual fish car, the Wolverine, which was a converted Pullman car. And in 37, that car served its usefulness, and the expense of commissioning a new one versus the fact that we now have a really good road system and trucks that can handle large loads, it was more cost effective to distribute by automobile than by rail.
Does the fish train car, does it still exist? Can people see it?
So it was scrapped in 1937. The actual interior components of the Wolverine, the people that worked on the train were so passionate about it, they saved the interior components and installed them in the employees' dormitory at the Paris State Fish Hatchery, so they could still live in the car in their dormitory. And then between 1998 and 2002, the DNR and MSU worked on a project to recreate a replica of the Wolverine at the Odin State Fish Hatchery, so people can go there and see a replica of it based on the actual components of the Wolverine. The original components, after it was taken out of the Paris State Fish Hatchery dormitory, it was donated to the State Museum, and it's currently on display in the special exhibit, The River That Changed the World, until next year, July 29th, 2018, it's on exhibit. So, sort of yes and yes.
But it certainly does seem that these fish traveled in style in their fish cans.
Well, I don't know about it in style. They were in converted milk cans, and they would have to be aerated so that the oxygen levels were maintained, and it was really hard work. But again, there was this fraternity on that train that even had a designated cook that traveled with them.
And overall, did the effort work? Were they able to stock Michigan's waterways with enough fish to keep the tourists happy?
Over time, I think the estimate now is there have been billions of fish planted, and we still have fish hatcheries, and we still propagate fish across the state. You know, starting in 1959, when organizations like Trout Unlimited sprang up, there's also, for certain rivers, the way to keep fish population stable is to protect the habitat, not just put hatchery fish in there, but it's a combination. It's a combined approach, and we're still doing it, and it still works.
Mark Harvey, the Michigan History Center. Thanks, Mark, for taking us down the fish train track.
Thank you.
The West Michigan-based jazz fusion band Desmond Jones is out with its self-titled debut album October 10th. After meeting in college at Michigan State University and playing gigs around the Lansing area, the five-piece band has settled in Grand Rapids. Stateside producer Mercedes Mejia spoke with two members of Desmond Jones about their eclectic style.
John Nowak and Chris Boda, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I have to confess, I was totally new to your music, and I really enjoy this album. There's so many different musical styles that you kind of get lost in each song, really.
Thank you so much. We don't take any offense to that. We're still getting out in the local Michigan scene, so we're excited for people to discover our new album.
I've seen that term jam band used to describe you guys, but I'm curious, how do you describe your own music?
We do a lot of jamming, that's for sure. We love the improvisational aspect of our music. We describe ourselves as rock, funk, jazz fusion. The album will be marked as art rock, which kind of involves a side of progressive rock and jazz fusion. But there's another side to us that really values songwriting, quick, sweet songs that have a nice structure for us with melodic lyrics and that we can kind of put out there so that the crowd can find something familiar with us show to show. It's kind of hard to pinpoint it because we have so many different influences and we touch on so many different genres while we're playing.
Well, let's take a listen to the song off your debut album. This is Good Song.
This is a good song, this is a good song. Don't you think this is a good song? This is a good song, this is a good song, yeah. But this is a good song too.
Our guitarist Isaac Berkowitz wrote this song. This is one of the newest songs that we've been playing, and we chose this one to be our lead single off this album because it's one of our nice, short, and sweet songs. I think it has a catchy chorus. I remember Isaac sending an iPhone audio message to me saying he's got a new song and he thinks it's a good one. And I remember listening to it that night and figuring out some harmonies in my head. And I just knew that this was going to be one of the songs that I really enjoyed playing. And in the last couple of weeks, we've had a really good reception. And now when we play it at shows, everybody is singing along to the chorus. And it's just kind of a fun song to put out there and give everybody a little taste of what's coming with the rest of the album.
And really, all five of you have super diverse backgrounds in terms of how you became musicians. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is Chris. So actually, none of us did go to music school. We all have college degrees and all studied various things. I studied finance. Isaac and John studied humanities and liberal arts. John even had another study in Spanish as well. Our bass player, John Loria, is a graphic design major. And George, our saxophone player, actually studied Russian literature. So it's pretty funny because I think we do definitely take music as seriously as people that go to school. So I think a lot of people are almost surprised that we have all these different things in our educational background. But most of our music education comes from extracurricular activities. Like I know I took a lot of private guitar lessons and studied under a couple jazz guitarists. John and Isaac were in drumline and in band all throughout middle school and high school. George played in a Blue Lake jazz camp when he was younger and toured Europe with a jazz band. So we have all these different influences that are so much, I guess, outside of the normal grain of some of the musicians that you meet that go to music school, which is kind of makes it interesting. I think that's where we kind of get a lot of our diversity and more unique sounds, is that we all kind of learned a little differently than the average professional musician.
And that diversity really comes through in this album. So I quickly want to listen to a few songs. This one is El Merchero, which has a Latin jazz feel. And then this one is Gold Till the Grave.
Yeah, a little bit of pirate rock for you.
And here's the song, I Recall.
Yeah, that one spans all over the place.
But as the snow turns into rain, I recall. Place from whence I came.
and then Get Along, the song which leans toward indie rock.
That's one of the ones that our bass player John Loria wrote, and that has a lot of really cool different elements to that. We love having that one on the album because it starts off really quietly with the bass harmonics, and in a live setting that can be kind of hard to grab the attention of people at a bar or whatever else is going on. So we're excited for people to listen to that the way it was intended to be heard. Like we mentioned, you have five members of the band, all with different musical backgrounds. So I guess I'm curious to know if you guys have any creative challenges when you're making music. I mean, who gets to decide? We're really lucky to have five different songwriters in the group because that brings five different influences, five different backgrounds to the table. And in 5 years, I don't think there's been one moment where somebody brought something to the table and we said, no, I don't think we're going to try that, or no, I think we should change the style on that. We're really open. We're open books. Sometimes our biggest challenge is that we are so ambitious that we want to learn everything. We want to play everything, and we want to jump right into new songs right after they're pitched to the group. We just have so much fun writing music together, and we're really lucky to have five guys who bring something to the table, and sometimes they're full, complete songs and nothing else needs to be done. Everybody just comes up with their own part, or sometimes they're just bits and pieces that we kind of sew together to create a new song. So sometimes our challenges are completing songs. I know a lot of us have songs that we've been working on for years, even since high school, but usually we're lucky that we are in a creative environment where we can help each other pump these songs out. We have almost 70 originals now that we play in a live rotation. So we're constantly writing and constantly creating, and it keeps it really fresh for us as musicians.
Tell me, what is it about making music in Michigan that is special, do you think?
Michigan has an awesome local community scene, whether it's in Grand Rapids or up north, Traverse City, Detroit, Kalamazoo, Lansing, where we came up. There's so many bands working together to put out creative, original material. And especially in Grand Rapids, we moved here about 2 years ago, and we found ourselves in a community that's really open to ground roots, original music. And we found a fan base in Michigan that we wouldn't want to move anywhere else for. We've built up a great fan base, and whenever we're out on the road, when we come back to Michigan, we feel really at home. We were able to secure a residency at the Tip Top Deluxe on the west side of Grand Rapids, where we played every Monday night from 9 to 1 for over a year. I think we did like 62 or 64 weeks there. And it was just an experience, an opportunity like that, that allowed us to cement ourselves in the local community scene. There's so many other awesome bands that we get to play with, like Jesse Ray and the Carolina Catfish, Mark Lavengood, Fograss, Melophobics. There's so many bands who are all supporting each other. There's no sense of competition, and I think people in Michigan just really want to hear that music, and they're proud of it. People are buying tickets for shows. They're filling up festivals, and it's just a great time to be a local musician in Michigan and all over the country, really. But I really do think we have something special going here in Michigan.
Well, Desmond Jones will be playing an album release show at Founders Brewing Company in Grand Rapids on Saturday, October 7th. You can find more information about the band and other gigs coming up on their website, desmondjonesband.com. Hey, John, Chris, thanks so much for coming on Stateside and talking about your new music.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
We've all been longtime listeners of NPR and Stateside, and we appreciate what you guys are doing for the local music community. We want to give a special shout-out to our manager, Kevin McKay, who is also an NPR fan. and has done so much for us in this album, and we can't wait for everybody to hear it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. After the break, some public entities in Michigan are turning to a new tactic to get around the burden of providing public records through the Freedom of Information Act. Sue the person or group asking for the information.
They get slapped with a lawsuit that's not permitted under our statute, and they incur those costs and fees.
And counting is taught to Michigan kids in elementary schools, but today is the day the schools count the kids so districts can get as much funding as possible. And that means missing or chronically absent students can have a big effect.
Every day is important. What we know today is especially important.
We'll talk with Grand Rapids Public Schools Mel Atkins about how his district's addressing the problem of chronic absenteeism. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today is Count Day. For school districts all over the state, it's crucially important to have as many kids sitting in those seats as possible. That's because this is one of the 2 days during the school year when attendance determines how much state aid schools will get. And there's work to do in boosting attendance in this state. A recent report from Johns Hopkins University finds that Michigan's chronic student absence rate of 18% is well above the national average of 13%. Chronically absent means a student misses 15 days of school a year for any reason, and that is linked with school performance and higher dropout rates. One district that has successfully tackled chronic absenteeism, Grand Rapids Public Schools. And with us now is Mel Atkins, the Executive Director of Community and Students for Grand Rapids Public Schools. Mel, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, definitely. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So today is Count Day. How important is today for the Grand Rapids Public School District?
We can't stress enough how important Count Day is. This is where we receive 90% of our funding for today. Every day is important. What we know today is especially important.
Is the district doing anything special, or are individual schools doing anything special to ensure as many kids show up today as possible?
That's a good question. Many schools are having what we call Spirit Week. Spirit Week, you have a lot of fun activities. We want to make sure that kids come to school, a lot of free non-uniform day for a lot of our students, so we don't want uniforms to be a barrier for kids to come to school. And the biggest thing we can do is relationships we build over these first 5 weeks of school continues over this, you know, this week of school as well.
Mel, what are the challenges as you work with these students and their families? What are the challenges families in your district face in getting kids to school on a regular basis?
So some of the challenges, we break them down to three different categories: myths, barriers, and aversions. Myths are getting the message out, every day matters. If you miss a day here, you miss a day there. End of the year, if you only miss 2 days in a month, it adds up to 18 days at the end of the year. Other things are really barriers. It could be basic needs, transportation, housing, food, safe paths to school. It could be street lighting. You know, when the weather changes, it could be snow, so you have to walk in the street. Some of the versions that we talk about are sometimes academic struggles. If a child is struggling in a particular hour, they may not want to go to that hour. Or sometimes bullying. If something happens at school, it can say, oh, I have a tummy ache at home. Can I stay at home? But the true symptom is something else. And so those are the things that we have seen over the years.
Mel, there are so many issues and challenges that school districts face with funding issues and teacher attraction and retention and curriculum choices. And amidst all these challenges you face at this district level, how much of a challenge is chronic absenteeism beyond getting the students to show up 2 days a year to be counted for funding purposes?
With chronic absenteeism, it hits everything. It's more than funding. It's more than, you know, getting kids to come to school, because that's just part of it. We know, and research tells us, if you don't come to school consistently, you're not going to make it. You're not going to achieve. In our district, what we have, we looked at it, if you miss 4 days of school, that's really the breaking point when you start to be successful or not successful. We have broken it down to figure out where's the tipping point if you're going to be on grade level in reading, or if you're going to pass this assessment, or you're going to go to the next grade, and it's as simple as 4 days, more than 4 days absent.
That is really stunning when you're saying 4 days. And you have had considerable success addressing chronic absenteeism, and you've gotten some national attention for your efforts in Grand Rapids. So tell us about this Challenge 5 initiative you're doing in the district. How does it work?
So Challenge 5, it's a grade level challenge for each school. So first grade, second grade, third grade has a monthly challenge who has the best attendance. And we had tied it to our PBIS initiative, our Positive Behavior Intervention Supports Initiative, and when we recognize good and improved attendance. And when we engage with parents, we have attendance teams, you know, that look at data on a weekly basis, and we provide personalized outreach. What we're able to do in this last few years is we reduce chronic absenteeism every year, except last year, for 4 consecutive years. There was a 2-year stretch in there when we reduced chronic absenteeism nearly 36%. Reduction. It was all grade levels, all subgroups for 2 consecutive years. And some of the things that have worked that we see is really five quick points that we do. One was district and site leadership. And under district and site leadership, the superintendent made it a part of her evaluation. And with that in turn, it made it a part of everyone else's evaluation. And so it became important. The second thing we did was community partnerships and collective impact. We knew when we first looked at our data in 2012-13, we had 36% of our students were chronically absent. We knew the problem was bigger than just the school district, so we needed the collective community to support us. This is when we had Kent School Services Network. We had Bleed to Become. We had a lot of different organizations come together and say, how can we support? The third thing was data and transparency. We said, we're not going to hide behind our data because we have a plan. And so we shared our data with the media. We put it on billboards. We put it on these leaderboards. We have it in the schools and saying, this is what it is, because we're not afraid to show our problem because we need your help to solve it. The fourth thing we did was engage families. And so our parent engagement, actionable messaging. So we created Parent University. Parent University was created by parents, for parents, and it's really a community collaborative to help parents reach their full potential. You have workshops, classes, modules on effective parenting.
So you're getting the parents into the school buildings with Parent University.
With a true voice this time, and it's saying, and we're really listening and saying, what do you need? Instead of us telling you what you do need, we're listening to the parents. And so that is so vital. And the last one is investment over time. Investment over time means there may be a year that you may not get the gains that you want, but tweak your plan because this is the right thing to do. And this is what we continue to do over the years.
And the importance of that name, Challenge 5, because what, you want fewer than 5 absences a school year with each
student? Correct.
You can make that a catchy slogan, can't you?
We did. It stands for Challenge 5, strive for less than 5. That's what we say. Strive for less than 5 days absent.
Is this something that could be replicated in other districts around Michigan? Are other districts taking note?
Oh, absolutely. So we're in the process of now of making our Challenge 5 initiative countywide. There's been over 600 districts across the nation have adopted Challenge 5 so far. And so, you know, the message is catchy. And the thing that I try to tell people, it's bigger than the message because you have to do the work behind it. If you're willing to involve the community, share your data, look at attendance team, and truly try to remove these barriers for families, then Challenge 5 is for you.
What are the biggest lessons that you've personally learned, Mel, through all of this work?
That's a good question. No, so I've learned that it takes time. You know, you want things to go quickly, and the families that really have true barriers to the reasons why a student cannot come to school. And so the more you can engage with families, and it may take more than a year, but don't give up on them. You know, our students and families, you know, they come to us how they come to us, and we love them just the same.
Doubling back to where we began with Count Day, Mel, what are your thoughts on the way that Michigan assesses school funding with days like today?
It's definitely the, I guess I would call it a necessary evil, that one day seems more important than others with funding. I wish it was a different model, but in saying that, at least in Grand Rapids, we know the rules of the game, and we know this is why we have to engage families throughout the year. So today is seen as just as important as every other day academically.
Mel Atkins, Executive Director of Community and Students for Grand Rapids Public Schools. Mel, thanks for speaking with us on Stateside.
Oh, no problem.
File a FOIA request, get sued. A journalist, taxpayer, government watchdog uses the Freedom of Information Act to request records from some public body, perhaps government agency or a state university, for example. The response? That public body sues the requester. It is happening in Michigan and spreading through the country. What does this mean for a free press and transparency of public information? With us now is Robin Luce Herrmann. She's an attorney with Butzel Long, where she specializes in media and First Amendment law. And she's general counsel to the Michigan Press Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
We've had some cases here in Michigan. So to give everyone a clear idea of what's going on here, could you briefly walk us through one of these FOIA requests that wound up turning into a lawsuit?
Sure. The first one that really brought this to the fore was a case involving the Greenville Daily News about a year or so ago. In that case, a reporter from the newspaper had requested personnel files, the jackets, for two Montcalm County deputies that were running for sheriff. They'd also asked for those records from an adjoining county that had two other deputies running. Rather than responding to the request and saying, we're withholding them, or giving the information, instead, the county filed a lawsuit, got a TRO, a temporary restraining order, against the Greenville Daily News, and essentially asked the court to decide whether or not they had to provide the requested documents.
The Freedom of Information Act is not new. They're doing something perfectly entitled to under the FOIA Act.
That's exactly right. And the public body essentially has three choices. They can provide all of the information, they can provide some of the information, or they can deny the information in its entirety. Instead of that, we're seeing a pattern where public bodies don't take the choices that the legislature gave them in the FOIA statute, and instead they go to court and sue the requester for their request. And that has all sorts of negative repercussions.
So the point of the agency filing the suit, it's not about money?
Well, it can be about money. Typically, though, what the public body says is there are competing interests here, and we want you, the judge, to decide. But it does have financial repercussions. So under the Freedom of Information Act, if a public body withholds documents, then a requester may go to court to obtain the release of those documents. And if they're successful in obtaining documents, then they are entitled to recover their attorney's fees and costs if they get those documents. In these kinds of cases, the public bodies essentially prevent the requester, even if they get the records, from recovering their attorney's fees and costs. And of course, they are dragged into court and incur the court costs and attorney's fees without ever having made a decision to pursue the documents in a court of law.
The point of doing this is what exactly? From where you sit, what are they trying to do with these suits?
On their face, the public body says, we don't know what to do, so they want a court to decide. Frankly, the Freedom of Information Act doesn't allow for that. The reason that this is so problematic is because it denies the requester the ability to make the decision whether or not they want to go to court to obtain the documents.
Because they just slap them with a lawsuit.
And they get slapped with a lawsuit that's not permitted under our statute, and they incur those costs and fees. There's also delay. Even though courts generally do a very good job in fast-tracking Freedom of Information suits, clearly that's going to take longer than the statute itself provides, which is essentially 15 business days. It also discourages people from sending out a FOIA request because they're afraid that if the public body doesn't like the request or has issues with the request, they're going to get sued. So it has a lot of negative repercussions for the requester.
Now, you mentioned the case that you talked about with the Greenville Daily News. Is that the first time we've seen this in Michigan?
That's the first time I've seen it litigated in Michigan, yes.
Subsequently, how many more cases have we had?
The next one was the MSU versus ESPN case, which recently came to a decision in the Court of Claims. And then there was also a variation on that in Grand Rapids, where MLive had sought some audio recordings that the city had, and the city ended up filing a federal lawsuit, not against MLive, but against others with respect to these recordings, and then said in the MLive lawsuit, we shouldn't have to answer this because we have a lawsuit pending.
Hmm.
And in all three cases, the judges ended up saying, essentially, that's not an end run around the FOIA formulation that our legislature put together, which is it's the requester that decides whether or not there's going to be litigation, and there's no ability for a public body to sue a requester and seek court intervention.
Are there more of these kinds of lawsuits in Michigan than elsewhere? How do we compare to other parts of the country?
You know, over the last 10 years or so, these have been popping up around the country. I don't remember ever seeing them before about 5 years or so ago. But we've had three, you know, fairly prominent versions in Michigan. Unfortunately, this trend can continue if the legislature doesn't put a stop to it, or if folks are ignoring these court decisions.
Because Michigan law does not address this yet. So what they're doing isn't covered by law?
Absolutely. I mean, the argument, Cynthia, goes something like this. The FOIA statute only permits a requester to sue. That's what the statute says. It doesn't allow the public body to sue. That's what the courts have said. So what's not there, you can't do. But obviously, that hasn't deterred at least a couple of public bodies in the state from moving forward and suing a requester.
What do you think is really at the root of this?
You know, one can question strongly whether or not this is a tactic to deter people from requesting information, and whether or not it's a tactic to avoid the attorney's fees that the requester is entitled to recoup if they are successful. There's also a possibility, too, where the FOIA coordinators aren't necessarily very knowledgeable about the law. Sometimes there are tough calls, and they're unwilling to make the tough calls, so they want to have someone else make those tough decisions.
A year ago, the Michigan House voted 102-5 to pass Representative Clint Kesto's bill that would prohibit public bodies from suing FOIA requesters. So then what happened? Where are we now with that?
Well, it hasn't gone anywhere to my knowledge. It's similar to the legislation that was proposed to open up the legislature and the executive branch of our government to more transparency and accountability. And there are those in the legislature who have said that the only people that care about that are the press, that our citizens don't care about it. Now, I personally don't think that that's true. If our legislators understood more that taxpayers, voting citizens cared about this sort of thing, I think we'd have a better chance of getting some action on these.
Robin Herman, General Counsel to the Michigan Press Association. Robin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Sarah Leeson, and Danny Hensel. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.